When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and Final Rise. On this episode of the show, we head west to talk chukar hunting with Levi Day. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 174. All right, welcome back to the Birdshot Podcast, everybody. Thank you for tuning in this week, as always. Great show coming up for you with Levi Day, talking primarily chukar hunting, hun hunting, talk a little bit about Levi's background, bird dogs, shotguns, shooting gear. Good stuff with Levi coming up in just a moment. But of course, I want to say thank you to all of my Patreon patrons. Thanks for your continued support of the Birdshot Podcast. We've got another Onyx Elite subscription card up for giveaway on the Patreon monthly giveaway. And a reminder that anybody who signs up for just $5 a month will get a set of Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a little welcome package. And you're eligible for all of the monthly Patreon giveaways. You can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. All right, a couple of mentions for Onyx Hunt. Earlier this week, I was assisting my friends at Onyx Hunt and Upland Institute, Ron Baim and Justin McGrail. They did a little webinar on dog training, which was very much like some of the podcasts Justin McGrail has done on Ron's podcast. Lots of discussion and question and answer on bird dog training and development with the one and only Justin McGrail. That webinar is viewable on the Onyx Hunt YouTube channel, so worth checking out there. And upcoming next week, I will be at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp for the Onyx Hunt Grouse and Woodcock Hunting Educational Weekend, which I'm very much looking forward to, selfishly, because it's always fun hanging out at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp, but also looking forward to those that will be attending that weekend. Hopefully some listeners out there will be at Pine Ridge next weekend. I know I've heard from a few of you. I'm looking forward to being there. It's going to be fun. Talking bird dogs, grouse and woodcock hunting, shotguns. I might even still have a turkey tag in my pocket. And when I drove out to Pine Ridge Grouse Camp last week, back and forth a couple of times, I saw turkeys every time. So who knows? Maybe my buddy Simon and I will be out chasing turkeys if we have an hour or two to spare. We'll see. But hope to see some of you at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp next week. And don't forget, you can always save 20% on your next subscription to Onyx Hunt using the promo code BSP20. That's BSP20. Save you 20% on your subscription to Onyx Hunt. All right, now for the worst part of today's show, at least for me. Today is Friday, May 13th. Huh, Friday the 13th, which I don't consider myself to be overly superstitious, and I was born on Friday the 13th, so I've always kind of thought a little bit differently about that day than maybe others out there listening. However, today most certainly feels like a Friday the 13th, as most people would think of it. The Minnesota Wild whimpered out of the Stanley Cup playoffs last night, lost three straight to the St. Louis Blues after having a 2-1 series lead and looking like they could definitely win that series. Aside from Kirill Kaprizov, Dolabil Kirill, Kirill the Thrill, absolute superstar, fun player to watch. The rest of the team did not seem to play up to the level that they showed they could play throughout most of the regular season. What a bummer. I went against my better judgment, let myself get emotionally attached to the team, and a first-round playoff exit feels about like a gut punch. But as a Minnesota sports fan, you can't make this stuff up, but surely we could have predicted that ending to the season. The best season in franchise history, by the way. First-round exit. I hate the Minnesota sports negativity, and I usually don't get into that too much, but man, you just can't make it up. On the plus side, being a Minnesota sports fan, I smartly budgeted that $100 I'm going to owe to Will Larson over at the Upland Rookie Podcast right after we made the wager. Had to be prepared for that. So lucky for Will, his Colorado Avalanche did what everybody thought they would do and swept the Nashville Predators and are seemingly untouchable at this point. It'll be interesting to watch that series against the Blues, see how they handle the team that the Minnesota Wild could not seem to handle. I don't know where I'm at with it. Not a real big St. Louis Blues fan, although I could make an argument that with those three Minnesota Blue liners, including former University of Minnesota Duluth Bulldog Scotty Perunovic, Hobie Baker winner, national champion, I could be convinced to get behind that team, but not today on Friday the 13th. It's just a little bit too soon, so congrats, Will. The Avs are moving on, and the Wild are done. That may be the last hockey update you hear on the Birdshot Podcast. We'll see how I feel about it. Maybe we'll talk to Will on a future episode and get a little update from somebody in the winner circle. All right, that's enough. Let's get into today's episode with listener of the show, friend of the show, Levi Day. Levi is currently out in Oregon, although he will be relocating to another Western state, which he talks about on today's episode. Levi and I have kept in touch, going back and forth, talking shotguns and bird dogs and shooting, and he tends to think about things in a very analytical way, as I tend to do from time to time, and we thought it'd be a good idea to jump on a call and dive a little deeper into some of those topics. And I found myself thinking a lot about Western hunting and some of the hunts that I have not yet had a chance to do, but surely hope to in the near future, and wanted to pick Levi's brain a little bit on some of his chukar hunting and Western adventures. So lots of stuff in this episode, from Levi's background to his bird dogs to shotgun shooting. We talk a little bit of gear, vests, boots, which that reminds me, go get yourself a Final Rise vest if you're in the market for a new vest. That would be a great choice. You'll hear all about it on today's show. So let's get into it. Welcome into the conversation and onto the Birdshot Podcast, Levi Day. All right, buddy. It's been a bit of a sputtering start to this, but I appreciate you hanging with me. It is Friday after all. It's a good day, man. I hope you're having a good day.
Yeah, it's going to be a fantastic day for sure.
What do you got planned? You gonna get outside?
Oh yeah, I'll get out today and run the dogs a little bit. And then right now we're in the middle of packing up our house, so there's all kinds of honeydews and things to get going right here. So
yeah, so give us the brief overview. You are in Oregon, right?
Yeah, currently,
but not for long.
For the last 4 years, I've been in Oregon. In a small town in north central Oregon, and I recently have taken another position that's moving me back towards home, back to Idaho, which I'm really excited about, and it's pretty awesome. Even that I'm going to be the director of athletics for a small community college there, and the mascot's the Chuckers, even, so it's a match made.
No kidding.
Yep.
That is too funny. Well, I might have to hit you up for some apparel, you know, from your college, yeah, you know.
Swag for sure, dude.
You could probably help out their merch department with a few new ideas, maybe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was really funny going through the interview process and some of the stuff that I would talk about with them. And just how it was definitely a marrying of the two worlds. I'm really, really excited. My wife and I are both really, really stoked to get back over there.
That's cool. Well, I'm like fully prepared to sort of dive off the deep end in this conversation, but I figure we should set the stage a little bit. You're obviously out west, and I wanted to talk to you to get a little bit of western hunting and hear a little bit about what keeps you busy in the fall. But let's go back to the beginning for you a little bit and talk a little bit about how you found your way into upland hunting, bird dogs, because as I know you now, you're an avid hunter. You know, you're spending a lot of days in the field every fall, and it's clearly something you've dedicated a lot of time, passion, and energy to. So where did that start and how did it develop, Levi?
Oh, going all the way back, it's, I can't really put my finger on where it all started. I was one of the little kids that would go down and, you know, back in the day of renting VHSs from the local, you know, markets that weren't even movie stores per se, and was renting Gordon Eastman's High Wild and Free, and was cutting out toy guns out of pieces of OSB and making scopes and putting toothpicks in them and duct taping them to the top. And like, all I ever wanted to do was hunt. And I was fortunate enough to have a grandfather that really fostered that and helped. And my dad helped to build that as well and create opportunity for me. And then I started chasing stuff as early as I could. I would run around. We lived on a ranch and then had a bunch of BLM behind us. And I had another buddy that it was every day after school, we were grabbing the shotguns or the 22s and chasing rabbits, or, I mean, every day it was some sort of an adventure. So it's been a major factor in my life for as long as I can remember, for sure. There was some brief times that because of athletics and things in my life, I was a college scholarship athlete, and that I still got out and hunted, but not near as much as I wanted to, and just had to devote a lot of time to honing my craft in that area. But as soon as I was done with all that, I was able to dive right back in. And all the way up to where now, I think last year I did 70 days in the field just behind bird dogs alone. So awesome. And I didn't count any big game hunting. And then the fly fishing I do too. I think the year before I tried to keep track because my wife and I were talking about something. So I decided I'm a numbers guy, which I know you can respect too. And yeah. I think I did 128 days in the field or something. So. Wow.
Yeah. That is definitely, that is something you have dedicated plenty of time to. But I absolutely can appreciate that and understand where you're coming from. Funny you mentioned the VHS tapes. I've got a funny little story about that. This came up on a podcast that I recorded earlier this month, I think. It was either that or March. Unfortunately, it did not air. I've got to sort of regroup with these guys from the Minnesota Grouse Dog Association. We had some audio troubles on one of the recordings. But anyways, one of the members of MGDA, Ryan, he brought up during our conversation about how he would watch VHS, you know, back then there we didn't have all the content and YouTube and everything. We didn't have the ways to access information or entertainment, you know, stuff for hunting and fishing. So it was VHS tapes. And there's one I used to, you know, my parents would bring me down to the local video store here, Video 47th, I remember, and they would have some like hunting and fishing, and I'd pretty much would rent anything. But there's a video. Would you know if I said the name Babe Winkleman, would you know who that is?
Absolutely.
Okay. I know he's like a Midwestern Minnesota guy. I wasn't sure how far reaching. I mean, he's pretty popular.
Oh yeah, TNN used to reach its way out here too.
Okay. Oh yeah. TNN Outdoors.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it was ESPN Outdoors, TNN Outdoors. I mean, whatever you could get Saturday morning, Sunday morning. Yeah, I was watching that and shooting Nerf guns and all the same stuff. Super funny. But Ryan mentioned there was a video. This he started describing this VHS tape. It was Babe Winkleman. It was called Gunning for Game Birds. And it was like an upland hunting VHS tape. And I was pretty sure I knew what he was talking about. We eventually connected the dots, but he had seen this, and apparently he had been trying to find a copy of this VHS tape, and he called the production company, and for years, like, he's never talked to anybody that had ever seen it or was able to find a copy. And I'm like, Brian, like, he remembered all these other segments about Sharp Tales and all kinds of other stuff that totally I drew a blank on. The only thing I could remember is there was a guy in Canada that had an English setter and he was hunting ruffed grouse. And I mean, I watched that like 15 minute segment, I don't know how many times. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I've got that VHS tape. And so after we got done recording, I texted my mom and she went digging through the closet. And sure enough, she found it, Babe Winkleman Gunning for Game Birds, the VHS tape. And there's that. And there was another one called, there's a Tom Hugler video, who he's a famous ruffed grouse writer and he's written books and stuff. And so anyways, my mom dug those VHS tapes out, and I might see what I can do about ripping those and getting them. But I was real curious if any of the listeners had ever come across that Gunning for Game Birds VHS tape and had seen that. I got to go back and watch, because apparently there's another local guide around here, Steve Grossman, longtime hunting guide, and I guess he was in that video. And I just, you know, I had no idea who these people were way back when, so I got to circle back. But I love it, man. VHS tapes.
Yeah, I can completely relate. And you know, watching fishing shows on TNN or ESPN, mm-hmm. like sometimes my wife's a little bit groggy in the morning or going around here and I want to give her a hard time, I'll start singing like the Bill Dance theme song still. And oh yeah, it's funny how that stuff just becomes ingrained from the time you're a little kid. And yeah, they would be on early, and I can remember setting an alarm on, you know, Saturday or Sunday mornings and getting up to watch Hank Parker and mm-hmm. Bill Dance. Yeah.
Well, what have you been up to? What have you been up to this spring? It's April 22nd today. Do you have a spring kind of wild bird season that you were running the dogs earlier this year a little bit? Have you been up to any of that kind of stuff?
I got out a little bit towards the latter part of February and early March. Everything's really paired up here right now, so I try to leave them. And I live out to where it's actually a challenge. It's like the blessing is the curse. There's been multiple days where last year I could literally walk out my front door and put dogs on the ground and cover as much country as, you know, I could do 12 miles and never run into anything else but birds.
Wow, that's cool.
So the problem with that is then when I go to take my dogs for a walk, it can be a real challenge mm-hmm. because especially my puppy, she just wants to bomb out and go find birds. So I actually right now have to drive into town and I'll go run the dogs at the golf course, where at least then she's just harassing the killdeer. But because there'll be days that I'll have, you know, huns in the yard. So right now, yeah, I'm not doing much as far as running on birds, but a lot of yard work. Yeah. I've made a couple trips over and trained with George a couple times and been able to help him some with some of the dogs that he's got going and just be a sponge, really. I mean, anytime that I can sit back and see what he's got going and spend time with him is always a fantastic time. So I do a ton of stuff in the yard. It's, you know, every free chance I get, that's kind of where I spend my time right now.
Yeah.
How about you?
Yeah, same thing. And I can, you know, I could easily say the woodcock have invaded the woods where my dogs and I like to get our daily exercise in. And for most of the winter, I've mentioned this a couple of times, but there's a few grouse in there, but my dogs didn't find them every day. So it's like, we're trying to get exercise really, but you know, if we find a grouse a week or so, you know, it's okay. Well, now there's woodcock in there. So yeah, and now it's April 22nd. So we had been seeing a few and that were kind of dropping in on some of the patches of open ground. Now we've kind of lost some snow and there's a beaver swamp in there. So yeah, same thing. I'm getting excited for turkey hunting and getting excited for this snow to completely melt, which has not happened yet, but it's supposed to be pretty warm and rainy this weekend. So I don't know, fingers crossed, we'll see. But I'm glad you brought up George, because George DaCosta, recent guest of the podcast, you, as I mentioned on that episode, were the one that connected me with George and said that you had checked out his book, and just wanted to thank you for making that connection again. Obviously, I really enjoyed speaking to George and got some great feedback on that episode. But how did you and George connect and start running dogs together?
It was actually just complete happenstance. As a griff, and I was living just 30 minutes up the road, and I can't even remember where or how I first heard about George. gosh, it escapes me. It might have been from Frank Puccio or something. I'd heard the name Frank Puccio, and I called Frank and I talked to him.
Who's Frank? I feel like I've heard that name too.
Yeah. So Frank Puccio is another guy that breeds Griffons.
Okay.
He's the one you heard George talk about, the Mr. Brown dog. It's one of the most decorated Griffs that actually passed away. I think it's been 2 years ago now, but was a very decorated Griff and has sired a lot of really great puppies. And Frank was the owner of that dog.
Okay.
So I can't remember where I first heard about Frank Puccio either, but I reached out to Frank, I think, and he's who then talked to me about George, because I was looking to do some puppy introduction stuff and I didn't have access to birds. And he told me that George might be interested. So I called George and we just immediately struck up. Not just great conversation, but had a connection. And he's someone that has just been instrumental in everything that I've done with dogs. I've learned a ton from a lot of different people, but the kindness that George extended to me, I could never repay him. He's just been fantastic. And, you know, the relationship has continued to flourish from there to where he's put on a lot of clinics, and I've went and spoke at some of his clinics, and, he allows me to kind of tag along and be a wallflower and soak things up. And I don't mind going and doing whatever I can to be around George. He's just a fantastic guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. And yeah, I'm going to encourage any listeners, if they had not heard that episode, go check that out for sure. How did you end up with Griffs?
Well, it kind of is an interesting story as well. So a good friend of mine, a guy by the name of Steve Speck, I don't know if you're familiar, he owns S&S Archery, XO Mountain Gear. He's one of the developers of them backpacks. He's a fantastic guy as well. And, I've been friends with Steve for a long time. He's out of Boise and he got a Griff, and I just absolutely loved his dog, the demeanor, and, the way that he was able to go and do so many different things with Greta, his Griff. And I was looking for at that time a dog that I could take and have be my buddy and do everything. In fact, Margot has, you know, I've called turkeys in and shot birds with Margot. Margot has bear hunted. Margot has been with me on deer and elk hunts. And then obviously, you know, spent a ton of days in the year chasing as many wild birds as we can. So she goes with me everywhere, fly fishing. And I was looking for a dog that was going to be something like that. And she definitely fit the bill in that. And Steve kind of inspired me to look that direction. And yeah, it really worked out great.
Very cool. Had you had exposure to pointing dogs, flushing dogs, anything like that when you were, you know, when you were getting your feet wet upland hunting? I mean, did you know you wanted some kind of pointing dog?
I had a few exposures, and every time, to be honest, they were horrific. I was the guy that, I shot my first chucker at 12 years old. I had a good friend in high school that we flat got after it. I had an old like 86 Oldsmobile, and every day after school we were hunting somewhere. And
love it.
Anytime that we would go out or we'd get a group of people together and someone would say they'd have a dog, and you know, you talk about the evolution of a hunter and what you're after it. And at that point in my life, definitely we were all about limits.
Yeah.
And him and I would talk about it all the time. We'd love seeing someone show up with a dog because we just knew we'd kill way more birds than them. And I know that sounds funny now to people, especially when they think chucker, like how on earth would you ever find them? And it was just, you know, young, and it was purely by volume. But then there's also specific objectives, just like I'm sure if you were to walk into the rough grouse woods, you could find birds too without your dog. But So I always looked at it as, to be honest, with where I was in the evolution of a hunter, it was more of a hindrance. And that was completely, you know, naive and not having a good understanding. I grew up with dogs and having cow dogs and everything on the ranch, but it was definitely not something that I was ready to really jump into. I felt, you know, like it was overwhelming, and I didn't have the know-how and the time, and I'd never seen it really done in a way that I considered proper. You know, all my exposure was not good. So I didn't have a dog for a long, long time. And then when I decided to go ahead and take the leap, and then I just started diving in and decided I was going to be able to do this different and integrating a lot of the training philosophies that I knew from spending so much time around horses and then cow dogs as well. And was able to start implementing the things that I know. And then also receiving help from George and others around, has made it like, I can't even imagine going hunting now without a bow.
Yeah. Yeah. You wouldn't go back.
No, not at all. And I think that in a lot of ways it was truly a blessing, because, you know, going back again, talking about the evolution of a hunter, because I am totally now where I have no problem doing 12, 14 miles in a day for two contacts. And if those contacts are the right kind of contacts, I'm happy. Like I don't even need to kill a bird. I kill the birds that my dogs handle well. And beyond that, like, I was thinking about it the other day, and I think actually after I listened to the podcast you did with Maddie and the lines between training sessions and hunting sessions, and I don't even think the lines are so blurred with me anymore, where I think it's more every time out with me is more of a training session. I love to have other people, but I'm the guy that's notorious for, like, you go on that ridge and I'm going to take this ridge, because mm-hmm. it's just all about me getting to watch my dogs do what they do. And if my dogs make a mistake, like, I have no problem if I'm walking up on a point and I have a dog that starts to creep a little bit because, like, my puppy she'll get a little bit competitive with me. I have no problem walking right over, picking her up and putting her back where she was and saying, whoa. And if the birds fly away, they fly away. I don't care.
Yeah.
There was lots of times this year where I did that, you know, and then was able to walk back over, pick up the shotgun, circle around and kill a bird for her. So yeah, my mindset is just completely different than it ever was. And I think I would have done nothing but probably cement my feelings on the thought that bird dogs were nothing more than a hindrance than a help based upon where I was in the evolution of a hunter in my early years.
Yeah. As blasphemous as that sounds, I can relate. Cause yeah, as I've mentioned many times before, I grew up hunting without a dog, and my first experiences with a dog I had some good ones, but they were, you know, kind of head scratcher, and there was a friction where it, you know, and it's a bit like just naive, just not understanding, you know, you don't know until you know, but like understanding the dog was just sort of hindering the way that I had developed over a long time of hunting without a dog. And I think I've heard people comment about that before, so it's not unusual, but yeah, then you spend some time with a dog, and, you know, if you're lucky, get a dog of your own. And I think we all kind of know how that story plays out, and it sounds like it definitely did for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And being a guy who spends as much time especially as I used to, chasing big game animals, like, what the experience needs to be for me is definitely one of solitude and quiet. And to me, I think of it, especially now, I've made reference to this quite a few times, but like when I put my dogs on the ground now, for me, it's like I almost hear symphony. Like, that's what it is in my mind. And it's a place of, I mean, it's cliche and it's used a lot, but like, it's a place of escape. So to be with someone who's yelling at their dogs and like, all like, that just was so off-putting for me. And I just knew there had to be another way to do it in what my eyes seemed to be a proper way, but I just wasn't in a position at that time to do it. And again, where I was all about just seeing how many birds I could whack. I could definitely always whack more birds than a guy with a dog. So
yeah, that's funny. Yeah. But that's, you bring up a good point too, in that, you know, not everybody runs their dogs the same way, and you can sort of curate your own experience. But yeah, I'm much like you in that way, where I tend to run my dogs. I'm not saying a whole lot. It's basically just me sort of just watching them work as much as I can. And then if I'm in the rough grouse woods, I'm looking at the cover and watching the birds when I can't see, or watching for birds when I can't see my dogs, that kind of thing. But yeah, and that's not the same way that everybody hunts or handles their dogs. And yeah, so I don't know. I think I would be very happy walking the ridge opposite you and meeting up, you know, and discussing the hunt at the end.
Absolutely. I mean, the tailgate time is irreplaceable, and I mm-hmm. absolutely love it. But the amount of time that guys like you and I put into our dogs and the relationship that you have with them, like, for me, they're part of our family. I mean, they, my wife and I don't have kids, and, you know, Margot is like, which is my griff, the sun rises and sets in my wife's eyes with Margot, and Josie, my little short hair, is just my little buddy, you know, and she goes everywhere with me. And they're just such an intricate part of our life that to make it about anything else for me is I have a hard time with that. And I want to give them every opportunity to be the best they can be. And in my personal opinion and limited experience, it just really seems like the human factor is always the factor that causes more issues than the dogs ever had. So I'm just really selective in who I usually go with and the people that I will let hunt over my dogs. And because I just want to see them be the best that they can be. And I just really enjoy that time and letting them do what, you know, express the work that we've done and also, you know, that genetic potential. And it's just super rewarding for me.
Yeah. You know, like when you do hunt with somebody new, I mean, you're taking a risk, right? Like you don't know how the day is going to go, but that risk is necessary to, you know, to maybe find, you know, that next hunting partner or that person that you really enjoy days in the field with. But you just never know that first day with somebody new or different, or that's part of the game. But when you do find somebody that kind of sort of sees eye to eye with you, or at least goes about it in a similar way, and you can have that, then, you know, that's when you get those tailgate sessions. And I mean, shoot, that's why one of the reasons that pulls us out there for sure.
Yeah, it is super challenging. You know, I've done quite a bit of guiding, and it's interesting that, like, I don't get as particular when it, I mean, obviously you don't have the option, but particular when I'm helping guide, because it's such a controlled environment, you know, when you, like, I'll help out at some put and take places, and I have the opportunity then to always make sure the dog's right and I'm not carrying a gun.
Yeah.
And it's just different. But when you go to run on wild birds, and I totally understand it, and I get why people are this way, you know, but you spend as much time, especially chucker hunting. Like, I mean, I was talking to my wife and we started kind of adding it up. And I think this year I averaged right around 40 miles a weekend, you know, and when you put those kind of miles in chucker country, it's like, I get why people want to shoot at them, but I'm way more hesitant to take or to go with people on wild birds than I am in a more controlled situation.
Sure.
For sure.
Yeah, I could see that. How often do you and your wife hunt together?
So this last year was her first season.
Okay, cool.
She has just been someone who's kind of dipped her toe in, and it's slowly starting to take hold. She actually shot her first chucker this last year.
Awesome.
And it was fantastic, and got to kill it over Margo. And that's what she wanted. She was like, I want to shoot a bird over Margo. So she did not come from a hunting family, but she's, you know, we've been married now for 16 years, but it's been a slow evolution for sure. And I think her then going and watching, which she's done a fair amount, but I would say, no, I think she only got out this year. She might've got out total of walking with me and carrying a gun 10 or 15 times. So it's been a slower evolution, but she's definitely expressing that, like, she's wanting to do it more, and she's seeing the joy, and she's been out and shooting some clays, and it's been really cool to watch the progression that she's had, and to see her find the joy in that. So no, you know, I spend a lot of time, I hunt with my buddy Tristan Henry, and then I hunt with another good friend of mine, Tony Guisto, and sometimes with his brother Mario and Nate Akey a little bit. But I would say, you know, 80% or 90% of the time I'm running solo.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can appreciate that. I don't know how many, I don't necessarily take notes of who I'm with. I could probably figure it out, but I don't know how much time I spend with other people or by myself. It's a lot by myself, afternoon hunts, getting out there and just running the dogs and stuff. I was mentioned on talking to somebody else the other day about how, as much as I love October is kind of madness, you know. There's the annual grouse camp weekends and all that kind of stuff, and that's when everybody's living the dream. I mean, it's a blast, but I really have come to appreciate the November, December, as long as the hunting conditions stay right, because then everything's kind of slowed down and it's usually just me and the dogs, and those are some of the best hunts of the year. But no, that's very cool. Obviously, it sounds like you were not pressuring your wife in trying to speed her along, and just sort of let it come to her naturally, and now she has the interest, and obviously the dogs played a big role in that. So that's really neat to see how somebody could, you know, find that inspiration just by association, being close to those bird dogs for a long period of time.
Yeah, it's been a really awesome evolution. And my wife is someone who's really, really excels from a culinary standpoint. Mm. And she loves the food, all things wild. And it's just the way that you and I think about shotguns and dogs. And like, I'm a guy who has a shotgun in my hand literally every day. She is that way when it comes to all things culinary. So
cool.
Continuing to want to search for that deeper connection with her food, not just in the fact that, you know, her dogs were able to go out and do that and her husband brought them home, but for her to actually take a more active role in that has been probably one of the most intricate parts of her deciding to move forward with that. I don't think it has much to do with me. It's definitely more about a love for food and the dogs, but it's been really, really awesome. It's also, you know, it's trying for sure. I think we forget when we've been doing something our entire lives, it's the little things even that we don't realize that they are actually a skill set. Mm-hmm. And something as simple as how to navigate terrain. And like, I don't even think about it and I just go, you know, but again, that's, you wouldn't think that walking in terrain is a skill set. And, you know, you boil it all the way down to it's the most simple components are still skills that you've had to acquire.
Yep.
And foster years. And sometimes being able to take a step back, and I'm sure you as a father have experienced that too, being able to take a step back and go, wow, you know, I need to teach this. And that's important. It's an important concept too, as well. So yeah, it's been super rewarding for us on all fronts. I love the time that I get to get out with her, and that's awesome. I look forward to more in the future.
That's cool. Yeah, there's a comfort level and a confidence level that, again, it just becomes, you know, inherent in what you do. But taking that step back and somebody that doesn't have that, it's a feeling of uncomfortableness, and we all know about stepping out of your comfort zone and how that feels like and how it, you know, it does lead to progress and learning and development, but it is challenging in its own right. I get reminders of that every day, and watching my 8-month-old son, like even just, you know, watching him try to pick up an object and how you're kind of like the light bulb goes on, like, wow, he still has to develop all these motor skills and everything. I mean, it's just, it's crazy, but very cool.
Right. Yeah. That's awesome.
All right. So we're going to transition a little bit. I'm curious, you're moving from Oregon now to Idaho. Obviously those states are right next to each other, but how much is your upland hunting, if any, going to change? Like, how much do you know about where you're going? And obviously you got, you know, some new adventures ahead of you and some new ground to explore, but do you think, I mean, is it going to be a lot of trucker, a lot of Huns, same kind of hunting, but what are the differences potentially?
Yeah, so I would say the lion's share of what I'm going to do is going to be the same.
Okay.
There's going to be a new country, but I'm actually moving to a town that I lived in for 9 years.
Okay.
So I know the area, and I've been around the area for 25 years. So I know a lot. There's still a lot left to be explored, and I'm really excited about the opportunity to do that. But no, trucker and hun hunting will make up probably 90% of what I do. Again, I haven't had an opportunity to hunt every bird there is, any stretch of the imagination. But for me, there's just, I mean, sharptails, I would put them right there with them, but they're just a proper game bird in my mind. They just, the manners.
Huns or chucker?
I think chucker more so than huns.
Okay.
I appreciate huns run a little bit, but not so much like, you know, a pheasant. They're enough to challenge a dog. And it gives me a great up training opportunity. Like, I love that about huns, that'll try to run away from my dogs a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But chuckers are they're just so honest. And I absolutely love that about them. Now, of course, you can find ones that aren't. I'm pretty fortunate in that, you know, I have access to places that allows me birds that don't see a lot of pressure sometimes.
Sure.
And then also I seek out places that a lot of people don't, because maybe the numbers aren't as high or the difficulty to get into some of them. So being able to get those contacts for my dogs on birds that just are so honest is so rewarding for me. I love the table fare of chucker. I love the difficulty of, really from a wing shooting standpoint, I haven't found a bird that is, you know, that can even compare. So I love that for sure, but I'm really excited. Like I alluded to earlier, try to get up and experience some more forest grouse hunting with my dog. So we're going to be fish out of water, and it's going to be awesome. Talk about comfort zone.
Yeah, there you go.
In fact, a couple years ago, I gave it a go with some buddies of mine, and I took this picture, and it was like, I think I captured it. I don't know. I put it on Instagram or something. That was like, you know, a bunch of chukar hunters trying to be grouse hunters. And like, we're sitting there together and our dogs are, you know how it is. It's the typical, it's like a Christmas card where you can't get the kids to hold still.
Oh yeah.
The dogs all, you know, look ridiculous. And yeah, we walked around aimlessly and, you know, I heard a couple birds fly, but it was like, gosh, we have no freaking clue what we're doing. So
It's such a different feeling when you're doing something like that versus, you know, your bread and butter, like the way that you would feel confidently be walking around your chukar covers compared to that, you know, it's just interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. I felt that way a little bit. Last year we went up to Montana and I got to hunt sharptails for the first time, and that was awesome too, but it's still just different to me than it is looking for forest grouse. Like the forest grouse thing, just for me, for some reason, my brain can't comprehend it yet. So hopefully we'll get it figured out.
Well, that there is, I mean, there's some stuff too, and I don't exactly know what the cover looks like out there, but when you're switching from open country to dense cover, I mean, that brings on a different level of claustrophobicness and all that kind of stuff. It's just a different feeling than I'm guessing some of the scenic views and vistas you're used to.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, you know, just using some intuition, definitely looking at topography and just trying to figure out, it's really amazing how many of these things are so similar, but yet so different, you know, and then across all worlds. So you start talking about chukar hunting, like, I know a lot of guys that are chukar hunters that are also big game hunters, and the two marry up very, very well.
Yeah.
Being able to read and understand habitat and country that it's going to produce and hold birds is very similar to that which patterns that big game animals are going to exhibit as well. So I think that the two worlds really do marry, even though they couldn't be further apart. You know, that Venn diagram is still present for sure, and that middle ground exists. And I think it, you know, again, just my personal opinion, they probably do as well with the forest grouse. And once I get in there and start kind of tearing it apart, it won't be as bad as I've got it thought in my mind. But right now, with the limited experience that I've had, and that I've only been out a handful of the times and have yet to shoot a pointed forest grouse. So we'll get it figured out.
But yeah, I'm sure you'll do all right. I want to get your thoughts on, like, talk to me about what, like, maybe an ideal chukar cover, and then we'll get into huns, but I'm just kind of curious, like, sort of cover elevation, that kind of stuff. Like, if you're going out for a hunt tomorrow, you're going to your favorite spot, what does that look like?
Gosh, this is the thing that's really awesome about chukars. It's like, it's not any help when you tell people, but yet, you know, maybe it is. The different covers that I hunt are so diverse. You know, last year I chased Utah with Matt Davis. I hunted chukars in Idaho. I hunted chukars in Oregon. And those habitats, although similar, vary incredibly. So in Utah, it was legitimate sheep country. You know, giving a specific elevation that those birds were at would give you no correlation then of where to find birds in Oregon.
Interesting.
It really is. Now, when you look at the landscape, yes, you're going to see some similarities. You know, you're looking for some green up early cheat, you're looking for some dense sage, but then depending on whether there's snow or not, you know, you're looking for south facing aspects that where those birds can be able to feed on the green up. But So to give you an example, the birds that we found when I went and hunted with Matt were clear up in the craggy rocks where literally you would expect a bighorn sheep to be. I think we climbed 2,000 feet from the base to the top. I want to say the elevation had to have been right around 7,000 feet. Now, where I live right now, I'm at 2,300 feet, and it's on the breaks of a river. So the breaks country, you're looking at long ridges, big steep drop-offs. Those birds really like to hang in the transition areas. I find a lot of birds right off the tops. So the top ends of this country might look CRP-ish. And then as you start to roll off into the draws, you're going to have some thicker cover. depending on weather patterns and what's going on. If we've got nice days, you know, those birds are going to be located, it seems like, for me. And some of that might have to do with time of day that I'm actually chasing them. But most of the time, I'm going to find them right in the transitions, coming off the tops down to the side hills and into some of the heavy cover. It's very seldom that I actually find chucker in big, heavy, dense sage. I do sometimes, but not as often as I would in the transition zones.
If we can talk about topography a little bit in a relative sense, knowing that it, you know, it's going to vary from region to region, area to area. If you're in a spot and you've got elevation, how do you approach that? Do you want to get to the top and be on top and have your dogs casting off and down to the sides? Do you want to be on the side hill? How do you approach topography in a general sense?
Well, the only way I can think to answer that is yes. I mean, and I don't, you know, it really depends on where you're accessing. So for example, in Utah, you accessed from the bottom and yes, the birds are at the top. I mean, a lot of that obviously has to do with where's pressure coming from.
Yeah.
Pressure's coming low, birds are going to move away from it. If you have an opportunity where you're starting on top though, some of those birds are going to move down more towards the bottom, depending on how much pressure they've had. But it is not uncommon for me to find birds in the upper ends. So like my general rule when it comes to, and again, this is just my personal experience, I think of chucker a lot like elk. I find elk in the upper thirds of all the ranges in the basins. Well, I'm going to find chucker relatively in the same spot. So yeah, I'm going to always look for the path of least resistance for myself. I'm very fortunate in that I have two dogs that really will punch into the country, one especially. And then my seasoned dog, who doesn't run quite as big, is very much objective oriented. Yep. She's got a lot of days in the field, and the majority of which have been chasing chuckers. So she has identified country that she knows chucker are going to be in. And my short hair, who oftentimes my watch this year read in miles, not in yards, just is sheer volume. Yeah, she's going to cast off down into either side and she'll go clear to the bottoms and come back up. And we can work these big long ridges then where I can stay up on top and only drop any in when I'm walking to a point. It really just depends on where you're accessing the country.
Sure.
And what the country looks like. I hate to, you know, I'd love to be able to give listeners a more definitive, like, this is where you go look for chucker habitat. You know, like I hear you guys talk about rough grouse and certain types of vegetation that need to be present and obviously water and stuff like that. But even with chucker, what can be difficult or not difficult, more refreshing, is that once you start getting some moisture, it doesn't take much. Like those birds aren't congregated around water and like they are in the early season. You start hunting chuckers in late November, December. They literally can be anywhere. So like that's the blessing is the curse, right?
Yeah.
And it really does come down to looking at those specific objectives where you're looking at transition zones, rock outcroppings. Can produce. I think a lot of people like to talk about rock outcroppings. And for me personally, I they can produce. I don't know if they're as big of an objective as they've been made out to be, but maybe that has to do with the fact that literally it is hard to describe like where to find them. I really relate it to like chasing sage grouse. People look at sage grouse and they see the sagebrush sea and there's like, oh my gosh, where could they possibly be? And there's subtle nuances in that. But they are really, really hard to articulate.
Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and friend of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com.
I would...
resonates with me a lot because I went sage grouse hunting one time in 2018 and I was with some folks that had done it quite a bit. And as much as they were trying to articulate those subtle differences, and part of it's just, we didn't see enough birds to get that, you know, to really connect the dots in my mind, but it totally felt like we're walking through a sea of stuff that all looks the same and, oh, we stumbled into some birds here and we stumbled into some birds there. But yeah, I absolutely get that.
Yeah. And as later season, you know, or as the season progresses, it does get a lot easier to start identifying specific zones because snow becomes a factor, right? So we're starting to look at south-facing aspects. When you can cut the country down by a large percentage, of course, it makes it look a lot easier. But early season for people, they just look at these mountain ranges or these big, deep canyons, and they're like, my gosh, they could be anywhere. And yeah. The truth of the matter is, that's correct. Like, yep. They could be. I found them in the most unassuming places, all the way down to the places that you look at when you pull up and you're like, there's going to be a covey of birds there, and there is. So I really relate. They're akin to elk again. You know, the old saying is you find them where you find them.
Yeah.
Or elk are where they are. And man, yeah, there is, again, some subtle nuances, but it's still, you just never know.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think it's probably been said about every game bird and perhaps every game animal. Grouse are where you find them. Chuck are where you find them. I mean,
yep.
But there's truth to that because you do it enough, you're going to see birds in places that you weren't necessarily expecting them. But the idea is understanding where concentrations might be and, you know, over time where you have seen frequencies of birds that would bring you to those spots. And then throughout your journeys to those areas, you're going to find birds in places that you don't expect them. And I mean, hey, that's part of the fun, right?
Right. For sure. I mean, if someone was brand new and they're like, okay, I want to be able to find chucker, what should I do? I think the easiest piece of advice I would give them is if you're starting in the bottom, or it doesn't even really matter where you're starting, is think about pressure. Where is pressure coming from? If everybody's accessing from the bottom, obviously most guys, you know, they say the average big game hunter goes in a mile and turns around. I would probably assume that the average bird hunter is relatively the same. Yeah. So you're not going to find much in the first mile or 2 miles. And I would definitely be pointing to the tops, like get to the tops as quick as you can. If you've got dogs that'll punch out into the country a little bit better, it's obviously going to be a lot easier on you to do the big climb first and then walk the long ridge and see what you can produce. And then I would also, you know, weather is such a huge factor because we can have such varying temperatures that time of year. You know, you can have 12 to 15 degrees at night and then be, you know, high 30s or 40s in the day. Well, those birds are going to want sun and want warm, which is also going to help, you know, show you that south facing aspect is probably going to hold some birds. So we're going to, the new green up is going to shoot up. There's going to be food, but the heavy dense cover, if you're early in the morning or later in the evenings, is, you know, the birds are going to be going to roost and looking for protection. So some of those straws that hold a little more sage or some isolated island pockets of dense sage cover could potentially hold birds. And that's where rock outcroppings kind of come into play again too. But time of day, weather, and then wherever the access is, you know, thinking about getting away from pressure is going to be pivotal.
So when you mentioned the outcroppings before, I did want to clarify, and I think you just did, but what is it that would be significant about those? Is it's a place where birds could go to maybe get some sun and warmth? Is that kind of the draw there?
Potentially, and also it can be roost cover.
Okay.
Yeah. And sometimes they can find, you know, small pieces of rock, you know, and grit. Those birds are eating grit. But most of the time we're looking at it for cover, for them as roost spots.
How much do food sources play a role? And I'm coming at this from the perspective of rough grouse hunting here. You know, we have, I mean, especially in Minnesota, I feel like, and I guess the areas that I frequent, they're not this. It's not the same everywhere. Where we don't necessarily have like fruit bearing shrubs, a ton of fruit that is going to pull in birds like a magnet. So, kind of like the way I look at it is like there's pretty much food everywhere. So I'm not always trying to isolate a specific food source. I'm just going where there's high quality habitat and assuming there's going to be food there. Is that in any way similar to how you think about food, or do you identify food sources and go inspect them?
I would say there's a lot of similarities to that, but it also depends on time of year. If we've got snow on the ground, again, those south-facing aspects are going to be opened up to where there is more food.
Yeah.
I would say thickness of cover, it relates more to sharptails. In that regard, you know, if you've got a place that's been heavily overgrazed, there's not enough cover to hold the birds. But that being said, I've also have some places that I've flown into in a Super Cub that look like there's absolutely no cover at all and there's tons of birds still. Right, so right. I don't know. I think that the snow is going to be the biggest limiting factor on that. Otherwise, early season, yeah, I think it's a lot like the rough grouse thing. That food is definitely everywhere within the type of landscapes that chucker normally are going to be in.
Yeah.
So, you know, cheat's a pretty prevalent thing, and it makes up a large majority of their diet.
That's a good takeaway. All right, man. We've been talking a lot about how to find chucker, where you might find them, the approach that you take to that. Let's talk about what happens when you do find chucker. You've got a dog on point. Some of the things that you think about in that moment that we all hope to achieve, right? Dog on point or dog making game, depending on what kind of dog we're hunting with. How does Levi approach that situation when you have hopefully found some birds?
Well, the first thing that I do is I see a lot of people that are in a hurry. And again, I think it goes back to our earlier conversation with what I want out of the situation, what I want out of hunting anymore.
Sure.
And for me, when it's about the dogs first, I'm not in a hurry. When I get a point alert, I mean, yes, I'm making my way there. I'm not stopping to eat a sandwich first. But once I get to where I can see the dog, I take into account several different factors. The first being terrain, in that not necessarily how I navigate to the dog, but where I believe the birds to be based mm-hmm. upon wind direction, and then knowing habits of chucker. Chucker tend to always want to get down and away, especially if you're hunting in steep country. So, and then with the wind at their back, ideally. So
makes sense.
So if I have, and then also taking into account when we talk about wind direction, we talk about thermals and where wind directions are going to be during certain times of the day. But if I have a stiff breeze coming back up a canyon and I have a dog that goes on point 50 yards below me and I'm up walking the ridgeline, that transition that we talked about earlier that generally holds birds, if I make the mistake of just dropping down or being in a hurry and going to the dog, even if I'm 15 to 20 yards off of either side, the first thing that's going to happen is it's about the time that I pass the dog, those birds are going to get up. Well, those birds aren't going to be most of the time, especially with pressured birds, are not going to be off the end of that dog's nose if they're in a covey. If you're picking up a single here and there, sure, chucker will hold extremely tight and a dog can pick up a single off the end of its nose. But the majority of the time, those birds are going to be have some distance between them and the dog. So you're already talking about a bird then that's 35 to 50 yards out and that covey gets up and they're going down and away. And you have poor footing. It's a violent eruption when they get up and they've already pretty much put you out of range. So people throw the gun up and they shoot. And every now and again, sure, we kill one, but oftentimes I see a lot of people drop legs, and chucker are extremely hardy birds. And it's just not a very productive method of going in or methodology from a wing shooting standpoint. So for me, if I've got a strong breeze going up, I'm going to circle down around the dog. This is another thing that I love about chucker, where they are so much manners around pointing dogs and are honest. Most of the time they'll give you the opportunity to drop down and get around unless you're obviously exposed on a ridgetop. But I try to keep to where I can see the dog to some degree, but I don't mind walking completely away from the dog to where I can't see him. Again, you have to have some trust in your dog, but
so you're trying to minimize the visuals that the birds may have on you, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I don't want them to see me. So I will circle down around and most of the time either try to come in from the side at the level that I believe that they are, and if it's in really steep country, that's usually the option that I take. And if it's not as steep, a lot of times I love to pinch the birds between me and the dog.
Yep.
And especially then where I'm on the downhill side, those birds are going to get up and they're going to go right over the top of me. Now, footing can be sometimes tricky with that, of shooting directly overhead. but it definitely presents an opportunity then to be far more successful. I like to think of it as Tristan and I talk about it quite a bit, that like, if they show me their bars, they're dead. So, you know, the big black bars that Chucker have on the side of them, it's a far more presentable target for sure when they show me their bars. If I can't see them and they're down in a way, man, the toughness that those birds can exhibit is just unbelievable. So I think that people really need to spend time in thinking about looking at what to do once the dog is on point, because wind direction, topography play such a huge role when it comes to chucker hunting, that a lot of people that come from the prairie country even come out where, you know, you've got a covey of sharp tails on point. Sure, there's some strategy, but it's wildly different. And if I think people always keep in mind that escape routes for chucker are down the way, will really help to pay dividends for sure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, if you've got a bird has a real preference for that kind of escape route, you know, it's natural to try to use that to your advantage, right? And man, you're speaking my language talking about pinning the birds between you and the dog and getting, you know, given the choice, I'd much rather shoot at a rising target than at a target that's down low and away. I mean, that's how my guns are set up to shoot rising birds, and most upland guns are. So yeah, that is a very, very good insight. And I imagine obviously the challenge is the terrain and the topography, making that hard to do at times, but as much as you can, I'm going about my ruffed grouse hunting in a very similar way. And that's the game within the game. If you've got a dog on point, as you're moving in, you're in real time analyzing the cover and the situation and hopefully the wind and all those factors as best you can, trying to pinpoint where those birds might be. And then once you sort of make that estimation, it's how do you try to put yourself in the best position as you imagine a bird leaving that spot, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, those are just my experiences, but man, it really seems like it completely changed my ability to have shots that were not only more ethical, but produced far more for me and for my dogs. And then getting to a point where I would just take a deep breath and realize like, I don't need to be in a hurry. And again, going back to that kind of more training mindset of that, not only then am I have to have patience and believe and trust in my dogs, but knowing that I'm setting them up for a much better opportunity as well. So, and then if you're finding those birds, the other thing that I think about, if you're finding them in situations where maybe it's not as, you know, big and steep, maybe it's a little more rolling terrain, then I always think about prevailing wind. And I want to push the birds up into the prevailing wind. They have a tendency then to want to have the wind at their back. So if I catch them up in a CRP or something like that, I'm definitely circling then to where I'm pushing them up into a stiff wind.
And they're probably, would that naturally kind of push them higher?
Bring them right back to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yep. High and bring them back. And yeah, easy to imagine a situation where if they've got a tailwind and they've got an escape downward, I mean, that's going to be very challenging for you, and obviously throwing the dog factor and all the safety and everything. Yeah, that's going to be a harder, harder go.
Yeah, for sure.
So what do you think about when it comes to shotgunning, shooting for chuckers? What makes an ideal chucker hunting gun for you? What characteristics are you looking for as far as weight, you know, all that stuff? What comes to mind?
This is you and I have talked about this in the past, and it's such an interesting conversation that I don't fully know if I have a concrete stance. So I do know that one of the biggest factors for me that I factor in what gun I'm going to take. So I have a 12 gauge, a 20 gauge, and a 28 gauge. My 20 gauge doesn't get very much work. My 12 gauge is a Beretta Silver Pigeon 3. And then I shoot a Rossini round body EM in the 28 gauge. The number one factor for me that I think about of what gun I'm going to pull out is terrain. Now, it's not in regards to what most people would think. Most people would think about taking the, you know, well, yeah, it's big and steep and you're going to, let's say we're, you know, it's no secret. Everybody knows about Hell's Canyon. So you're going to go hunt Hell's Canyon. 90% of the time, I'm not taking the 28 gauge. I'm carrying the heavy gun. Or heavier, I'm going to run the 12 gauge.
Yeah.
The reason being, again, is that with chucker, the deeper the terrain, the more we seem to get strong prevailing winds. strong prevailing winds are going to create more scent for birds. My dogs have a tendency then to, and maybe this is just my experience with my dogs and some of the other dogs that I've hunted with, but they will have finds on those birds at farther distances. So it's not uncommon for my dog to go on point or other dogs that I've hunted with at 50 or 60 yards from those birds. Sometimes the terrain doesn't allow me to get into perfect position where I'm pinching birds between my dog. So if I know that it's going to present opportunities for a little bit longer shots where the birds are already getting up at 30 yards, the advantage of the 12 gauge is undeniable. Mm. Again, with that said, I'm not a guy who's a big advocate of, you know, the big 12 gauge loads. I just don't, from all the pattern testing I've done and the work that I've done with them, and maybe I'm just a ninny. I don't enjoy the heavy recoiling of an ounce and 3/8 at 1450 like that. It's not something that
sounds like such a heavy load.
Oh yeah. I mean, I just can't. Yeah. I don't like shooting them. I run an ounce and an eighth of sixes, and out of the 12 gauge, the pattern's absolutely spectacular. And having that extra weight, maybe this goes back to, you know, my experience in the big game world and the rifle world. I've done a lot of long range shooting, and I know the disciplines are wildly different, but at the same token, there's something to be said for that gun that offers a little bit more weight in counteracting high heart rates, uneven terrain, the ability to swing smooth as in comparison to the lighter weight gun. Now, obviously we're talking about different payloads and, different terminal killing power with the two at those distances. But I find personally that if I'm hunting in country that is going to present more difficult shot angles, I'm taking the 12 gauge every time.
Yeah. I like the thought process there, thinking, you know, potentially, I mean, the wind factor is really interesting. That's something that I haven't thought about in the same way, obviously, because it's not that kind of a factor, I don't think, but to a certain extent, you know, windier days, I could easily relate to windier days make for jumpier birds, generally further shots. You know, that's something that I don't think that specifically applies just only to chucker hunting. I think that's a great observation. And yeah, to your point, the 12 gauge is going to be the most effective, efficient killer with the most downrange pattern density. You know, well, we could obviously go down a rabbit hole of all the different variations in payloads and everything like that, but just in a general sense, yeah, I follow you. So what conditions will set you up to pull out that snazzy little 28 gauge you've got?
Well, the 28 gauge comes, and I shoot it a lot too. Yep. So, but in thinking about that question, I was like, okay, you have to kill a chucker today. You know, someone says you have to, or like when I traveled to Nevada to go with Matt, that was, I mean, some of the most gnarly country ever. And yeah, I don't carry the 28 gauge. Yeah. I'll take the 28 gauge when I'm hunting country that is more forgiving, and it's going to present shot opportunities where I know that I'm not as exposed to where the birds can't see me as easily, which is another huge factor in hunting big, steep country, right? As soon as you go up on a ridgetop, everything around you can see you.
Yep.
So when I'm hunting a little bit more forgiving country, I'll have a tendency to pull out the 12 gauge or the 28 gauge, excuse me. I feel like that with my dogs have a tendency to really punch up into the scent cones a lot stronger. And I have much more of an opportunity than to put an approach on where the birds cannot see me or it conceals my positioning until I'm already in a position with the 28 gauge that is well within its effective range, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. That's makes a lot of sense in thinking about it that way. Just knowing that if you have the idea that you're going to have shots that are going to set up better for you, you know, you've got less effective range with the 28 gauge. So you're going to use it in those situations. Whereas another situation where you're a little bit more rugged, rough country, thinking about maybe not as consistent of a shooting opportunity, pull out the 12 gauge right that day. Yeah.
And it's really counterintuitive to what most people say, you know, the general,
right. As far as that weight and carry and everything. Yeah.
Right. That's where people put their emphasis. And again, I come from, my background is in the fitness world, and I've always figured that
Like, so let's say if you really start, doing the math on things, if you're carrying an ounce and a quarter load is really popular in the 20 gauge for
In a
chuckers.
20
So if I'm
gauge.
carrying,
Man, that's like a
yeah,
3-inch
a lot of
shell,
guys
basically.
shoot, yeah, that like a 3-inch Prairie Storm.
Yeah.
If you're carrying an ounce, a box of ounce and a quarter 20 gauge, and you're carrying a Browning Satori, it weighs, let's say 6 pounds, 10 ounces, or something like that. And if I carry a Beretta Silver Pigeon in a 12 gauge that weighs 7 pounds, 4 ounces, and I'm running an ounce and an eighth of 12 gauge, the difference in the weight of the two of what I'm actually carrying is null and void.
Yeah.
But everybody's like, well, the 20 gauge is lighter and that's what I should carry. Well, okay, but what you're actually carrying is wildly different. And the difference in, we start, talk about going down the rabbit hole of pattern densities and shot string and all of those other things. Like, you're actually putting yourself potentially at a handicap
Yeah.
by thinking that you're carrying less weight and that that's going to save you and you're having less pattern efficiency. And actually having some of that weight in the gun, in my experience, is very, very beneficial working against, again, we're not walking up. I mean, everybody gets an elevated heart rate walking up on a pointed dog, but it's a whole different story when you've done 12 miles and you've just climbed 500 feet to your dog. It's another element of a high heart rate, because not only a high heart rate, you can't breathe and your
Yeah.
footing's not very good. And something about having a little bit more weight in your hands to counteract some of that and smooth out the swing, has really been beneficial for me in my experience.
Yeah.
So, and it's hard because it seems like, I really appreciated the episode you did with Lars. And man, there's so many people out there. There's such a wealth of knowledge.
Yeah.
And but it's just interesting how our experiences can produce different opinions, I guess.
Yeah, and I think in general, the more conversations I have like this, the more you learn. It's like at the end of the day, sometimes we have to simplify things in our mind in order to just simply make a decision, right? And because
Right.
this rabbit hole is a good way to put it, of shotguns shooting and ballistics and everything. I mean, you can analyze it to death and to the point of indecision. So it's real easy for me to see how somebody would come to the conclusion, light gun, done. Decision made, right? I'm gonna
Right.
carry that. But the point that you're trying to make, and I think is valid, is that there are a lot of factors that go into the weight of a gun, the amount of payload you're shooting, what that does to shot string pattern efficiency. There is a lot there to understand and grasp. So just sort of exercise caution in making a general assumption about something. And you can go as deep as you want to go in trying to learn and understand this. It's something that I do from time to time, especially when I'm talking to people like Lars and trying to deepen my understanding of it all. And I have an interest in that, but there are lots of things at play when it comes to shotguns shooting, what you're carrying, how you're getting there, and how you're sending those pellets down range. It's a big can of worms.
Oh goodness, yes. Yeah. And I'm with you. I mean, the knee jerk, I completely understand that. Grab the lighter gun. The other thing that I often think about, and I think that it's very common with all of us, that are in this game, we are pretty analytical and we like to research. And I mean, it's a way to be part of the hunt all year long, right? And I love that, and I'm the same way. But then when you do break it down to the lowest common denominator, I think about, again, it goes back to talking about fitness levels. Like, let's take the average Midwestern person that wants to come and hunt chuckers. How deep are they going to realistically be able to go? So that's something that needs to be a factor. And then the other then to think about is there other things that we could do to mitigate maybe that half a pound, that if you're worried about taking a half a pound off a gun, maybe there's other things we could do in preparation to where the half a pound's not as big a deal, but yet the half a pound being in the gun increases our opportunities of being successful. Does that make sense? You know what I'm
Yes,
saying?
I 100%. When you were talking about the weight of ounces and stuff, it's like, yeah, we might laser focus on the gun just in order to simplify things. But if you take a step back and look at your whole gear setup and in your rig, I mean, you could start shaving weight in any number of places, right?
Oh yeah, and let's backcountry archery hunters or hunters in general have been, pondering this for the last 15 years, and companies are making. The saying's like, you pay $100 an ounce. you know, to shave weight and all your gear that you're looking at, you know, when you start talking about like backcountry bow hunting or whatever. And you start thinking about that in terms of what you're carrying in your gear. And then again, in your preparation, like if I'm someone who's physically prepared and working really hard at it, and I know that I can get to where the chucker are, I would sure hate to handicap myself by knowing that I was potentially carrying a weapon that was not going to give me the opportunity when I drove all the way from Ohio to come hunt chuckers, because I took the 40,000 foot view and decided to pack the gun that was the lightest gun instead of the gun that was maybe going to give me the best opportunity when I maybe could have tweaked my food intake or done a little bit more work with my fitness or even my gear setup, in knowing that realistically, I'm hunting in January with one dog. Do I really need to carry 32 ounces of water for myself when I'm doing a 5 mile trip? You know what I mean? And I just think that the 40,000 foot view isn't always necessarily the best way to look at it. And there's a lot of other things for people to consider with when making some of those decisions. And I would sure hate to do all that work and drive all that way and then be in a situation where the tool that I had in my hands maybe wasn't the most effective to get the job done.
We could throw in a very shameless plug too for our mutual friend Matt, and you know, Final Rise vest. You could probably shave a few ounces off your normal hunting vest
without
too.
Question.
and carry that weight and carry the load better.
Not only are you saving weight in what you're carrying, you're looking at a system that you know, from an ergonomic standpoint, is putting you in a much better position to be able to cover more country. And then you can start talking about footwear, and you could, I mean, there's so many other things that we could look at that we just like to oversimplify, I think, and say, well, take the light gun. And for me, that has not been the most productive tool. And I believe even if it was in a 12 gauge, I still feel like, based on my experiences, that having a little bit more weight, and again, we're not talking about, you know, an 8 pound sporting gun,
right?
But having a little bit more weight really seems to pay off in those opportunities when it comes time to shoot. And for me, carrying doesn't really, I'm carrying the gun broken over my shoulder anyway, so I don't notice the difference between whether I'm carrying the 28 gauge or the 12 gauge or not. It doesn't, it's all the same.
I'm not going to entirely leave shotguns yet. I have a question with you or about something, but you did mention boot. I figured I'd probably be remiss if I didn't touch on the chucker hunter's boots. What's your brief take on boots? What do you like and what do you look for?
Man, that's a tough one. So I run a rotation right now. I did of two different boots last year. If I base it off of like a flex rating, you know, so Crispy has a flex rating, you know, 1 to 5, 1 being more flex, 5 being the stiffest. I definitely, again, a lot of, I'm not a podiatrist by any means, but it goes back to the strength of your feet too. If you're someone that walks around and wears boots every day, you're potentially going to get along with a little bit stiffer boot much better when it comes to navigating trucker terrain. If you're someone that, you know, rocks Chacos all the time or tennis shoes, you can probably have more integrity and strength through your feet and can handle a boot that's maybe not quite as stiff. Chucker live in such a variety of country that, you know, there's nothing worse than going and walking a bunch of CRP, or which would be akin to the prairies in Montana, and wearing, you know, a boot with a flex rating of 4. Like, it's definitely going to put you in a situation where we're having some foot pain. I run a 2, a 3, and a 4 right now. If I, again, if I base them off of a flex rating standpoint, and it, again, it all depends on what the terrain is and looking at it. A stiffer boot is always going to, if I'm hunting Hell's Canyon, a stiffer boot is going to offer some benefits that, a more flexible boot wouldn't have when it comes to, you know, digging your toe in and being able to climb. But a good pair of boots is definitely invaluable. If I was, you definitely need to look at something that's going to be waterproof. I'm also a huge fan of wearing gaiters, not just for the basic reasons that gaiters exist. Also from a standpoint of keeping your legs warmer, and the benefits that that can definitely have when it comes to looking at people that start having IT band issues or other things that might then express themselves in knee pain. that really aren't from the knee could directly be mitigated from, you know, wearing something that was helping to keep your legs warm.
Interesting.
So, so I'm a big proponent of that for sure. And you have to really look at what fits your feet, right? Everybody's got a different take on what they think the best boot is. I wear a pair of Hanwags that I really enjoy that are a little bit stiffer boot. They're definitely lightweight, but are a full waterproof boot. They are have some synthetic to them and some rubber. I'm a big fan of a big rubber brand. And then I also wear the Crispy Nevadas, are a boot that I absolutely love. Like if you were going to buy one boot that I think can, it's a flex rating of 3, can cover a lot of different upland situations and big game for that matter as well.
Is the Nevada, the Crispy Nevada, is that, it's a little bit shorter, like an 8-inch maybe?
Yeah, it's an 8-inch boot. Okay. It's a full leather boot with a rubber rand.
Yep.
It's just a fantastic boot. I have friends that are blown away the amount of time. I'm not a very big guy, so I'm able to get a lot of wear out of my boots, or maybe I'm just easy on them. I don't know. Like these, some people go through a pair of boots every season. I'm about to start my fourth year in a pair of Crispy Nevadas. Again, I alternated them, but yeah, I did 70 days last year just chasing Tucker alone. So
is that, how is that for like 8 inches? Not like, it's not like not a tennis shoe, but like, is that, how much are you giving
just
up
above the ankle
support? So you've got your ankles fully in the boot at that point.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. And they might be a 9. It's either an 8 or a 9.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
I know that that boot has been, it's been in the back of my mind since I hunted with Matt Seidel of Onyx a handful of years ago. And that he was wearing those and I was kind of like, oh, that, you know, I need that. But I was at the time I wear rubber boots here a lot because we do have really wet covers, but the last couple of years has been dry. And so part of me asking you this question was that, you know, you kind of know where I hunt. Obviously I don't need a super stiff boot here. We don't have nearly anywhere the elevation. And then when I do go out west, it's generally, you know, kind of rolling terrain. So I was going to ask you like, but I am in the market for, I want a good high quality, like leather waterproof boot. And I'm just sort of like, I don't know. I haven't looked into that world a lot in the last couple of years.
Yeah. And my gosh, you know, you could get lost in it.
I know.
Right. I think that finding something that fits your feet well, and I'm not saying necessarily a pair, but like I think certain brands tend to, you know, cater to certain foot types.
Yep.
I think that there's a lot of great companies out there right now that are producing, you know, aftermarket footbeds have improved exponentially. I mean, you can go all the way from buying, you know, Superfeet, which everybody knows and has been around forever, to Sheep Feet, which is, you know, doing custom molded inserts for your feet out of Utah. And I think they're fantastic as well. But if you're someone that has, you know, the middle of the road guy who doesn't, let's say, have any foot issues, I don't ever have much for foot pain. I will get some foot pain if I'm wearing too stiff a boot in too flat a terrain. And the interesting thing that I don't fully understand is there's a heat component that's tied to that as well. It seems like if it's colder out, I can get away with it. But if it's a little warmer, like we start getting 45, 50 degrees, I'll have more of an issue, which I don't. I would love to hear if someone could enlighten me on that. But I really get along well with Crispies. I think they're a great boot. The Nevada has been fantastic. I've done everything from, you know, August archery hunts in Nevada. I've chased antelope in Montana, elk in Idaho, and then, you know, I shot a mountain goat in them in Idaho. They've been absolutely amazing for everything that I've wanted to do, from upland hunting to big game hunting, all the way across the board. I wore them in Montana walking the prairies as well.
Yeah.
Good
versatile boot.
Yeah, for sure. Crispy has another boot that I've been looking at potentially getting as a lower flex rating. I want to say, well, they came out with their Ativa Mid GTX, which might be a boot that you would really like, especially for...
That's kind of like that high top sneaker looking thing, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wes Larrabee had those out when I was out hunting on the prairie last year. And I think he might have had the ones that were even lower, like tennis shoe. Like, I think there might, is there two versions? Do you know? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, they do have a lower version.
Yeah, and he had the gaiters. He had gaiters with him, which was cool. Obviously, keep the stuff out there. But I mean, you know, it's a beautiful day out there. It's mid September. I'm looking at those things like, man, I'd love to be cruising along in those things.
Yeah, I think a good friend of mine, Dan Staten, he rocks them a lot for early season elk hunting and really likes them.
And they are waterproof too, which, like, when you look at it, you don't think waterproof, but the idea that you could wear something that light and be waterproof, and yeah, it was appealing to me, at least on the surface level.
For sure. And then they had I can't remember what they called it. It was like a Pro GTX maybe, or something like that, that had that, the less flex rating again. So like it was a 2 that looked like it would be a fantastic boot too, that would fit the needs of what you have been talking about. And then I know the Laponia is a boot that Matt wears a lot, Davis, that also has a flex rating of 2, and he has absolutely loved it. Okay. And it laces all the way down to the toe, a really nice, good custom fit. It has a synthetic rand, and just a fantastic boot. And again, it's an 8 or a 9 inch boot that I think, yeah, would really serve you well in your home terrain as well as when you went out west. And we're talking about, like, you know, 1.2 pounds a boot.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, I got some homework to do, but I appreciate that. I was definitely curious when you mentioned it. We're going to finish up here in a little bit, but you did mention 6-shot when we were talking shotguns and shooting. Is that kind of your preferred shot size when you're out hunting?
Yeah, this is where I overly simplify. Maybe I absolutely love the terminal performance of 6-shot, and still having a good amount of payload out there. And yeah, I use 6 for just about everything. Yeah. I'm not a guy that's looking to kill 50-yard birds necessarily. So it really works well for me for everything from pheasants to quail to all of the prairie grouse, everything. It's pretty much what I've run.
Yeah.
It's a little much for huns, but I have so much overlap for chuckers and huns that I really do like 6-shot for chuckers. I know a lot of guys that run 7.5s and do really well, but I like that extra of the 6.
That was the other thing I was going to ask you. When it comes to hunting chuckers and huns, are you mixed bagging it? Meaning, are you getting into these birds on the same walks, or is that not even, I mean, I'm just like ignorant.
Yeah. It depends on where I'm at. Like, places I go in Idaho, yes, absolutely mixed bag. Places here, that I hunt in Oregon. So if I'm looking at a canyon system, I can look at it and say where we could deliberately go and do a walk for hunts and we'll find hunts. There could be a chucker up there, but let's say with the 80% certainty that any of the birds that our dogs find are going to be huns. And then the inverse of other country, I'd look at and go, okay, there's probably an 85% chance to 90% chance this is just chucker country. There could be an occasional hun, but more than likely it's going to be chuckers, but they could be within the same walk. Like, you know, you could walk the top end that is CRP that would be very much akin to, you know, short grass prairie, and then drop down into the canyons and pick up chuckers. So yeah, a lot of mixed bag opportunities.
Super cool. When you're carrying the 28 gauge, 3/4 ounce load of 6s.
So I have not spent as much time yet with the 28 gauge and patterning and finding it out. And this is stuff I can't wait to pick your brain about. You enlighten me, because I know you have a lot more experience. I've only been shooting the 28 gauge now for a year. Most of the knowledge that I've gained thus far has just been, especially the climate that we had the last couple of years, and ammo availability has been really hard. So Matt really helped me. He's been a longtime advocate of the 28 gauge and shot it, and he loves a 1 ounce load. So I wasn't able to find any of those. I'd always been a fan of what Golden Pheasant had done in the 20 gauge.
Yep.
Yeah, I really liked them. So I picked up a box of 7/8 ounce in 6-shot. And I patterned them and really was happy with the pattern and was able to get a case of those. And those are what I ran all last year. And at this point, it hasn't left me yearning to try anything else other than the fact that I love to tinker. So I'm definitely open and nowhere near an expert on the 28 gauge. It's definitely counterintuitive to everything that I know you and I have learned or have talked about when it comes to, you know, people that are wanting to run high levels of payload through, you know, holes that shouldn't be having them. We start talking about pattern efficiency and density, but yeah, I don't know. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you think I should be running out of the 28 gauge. The 7/8 ounce load has really worked well for me, but I'm definitely, it's interesting to me that they're running it at 1300 feet per second, at least an advertised speed of 1300 feet per second.
Yep.
I do wonder if I would gain more going to a 1 ounce load and slowing it down to 1220 or 1200 feet per second and gaining more pattern density, even though that because of the reduction in speed would help me with that, even though, you know, you are maybe potentially running a longer shot string. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have a ton of real world experience with the 28 either, because I've been sort of without a 28 gauge for a couple seasons now. But I've gone through all those same thoughts, and I will have a 28 gauge this fall. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm, you know, I'm a tinker like you, and I'm looking over across the room here at a box of Fiocchi Golden Pheasant 28 gauge. They're 7.5 shot. I love. This is coming from a guy. I'm a big fan of the Fiocchi Golden Pheasants. I've shot a lot of them in the rough grouse woods, specifically in 20 gauge, because it's a 1 ounce 20 gauge load, which is a little, you know, it's a little higher payload than the standard 7/8 ounce load you would think of for the 20 gauge. It only runs at 1245, so it's not obnoxiously fast. It's plated shot. I've had really good luck with them. I've shot paper with it. I've patterned it, but that's about the extent of my expert knowledge on it, which, you know, it is what it is. Like we do some patterning, and then we go out and shoot birds, and we make hypotheses and theorize about certain things, but I'm definitely not an expert. But I'm mindful of the square load, and I think it's helpful to understand why you wouldn't want to extend your shot string in two extremes. But then I also am of a mind where, well, what advances have we made in wad and shot technology, and what can we get away with, right? Because
absolutely,
at the end of the day, I mean, pattern density and pattern efficiency is what we're after. And I mean, I want, if I pull the trigger on a bird, I want the bird to come down. And so if I can increase the effectiveness of a gun by adding pattern density or pellet count and not have detrimental effects, why wouldn't I be interested in that? Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, 25 more pellets between the 7/8 ounce to the 1 ounce, you know, load in the 28 gauge, 25 pellets is 25 pellets. And if I slow it down again and I have more density with those 25 pellets too, like, why would I not do that? Now, I mean, I shot a lot of birds last year with the 28 gauge. And was very happy overall. It does take restraint.
Yep.
In my experience, you know, if you're a shooting machine, like, again, we keep talking about Matt, but Matt is a fantastic shotgunner. He can do things I can't do. And, that's awesome. But if you know your limitations, like, I was very, very pleased with the 28 gauge and what it did, but I do have a hankering to try to get my hands on some 1 ounce load, whether it's the, you know, the Winchester Super X, or I know Rio makes a 1 ounce load. Mm-hmm, yep. It's really interesting too, when you start looking at how many 1 ounce loads companies are making, and it's not just the American companies.
Yep.
Which is fascinating to me. Then,
yeah. B&P makes a 1 ounce 28 gauge load that I had a box of those when I had my 28, and I shot some sharp tails with those. Yeah. I'm right there with you. It's a bit of a black hole, and there's a podcast that I kind of have in the back of my mind that I want to dive into some of this stuff a little bit deeper in sort of like what makes sense when it comes to upping payload and what doesn't make sense. Right.
Right. And it's really difficult when you start talking about it, because you really have to, sometimes being able to articulate it in a manner that makes sense is a little bit difficult.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because, you know, you're constantly trading this for that. Well, what about this or that? And you can just end up talking in circles if you're not careful. And at least I can. Yeah, I would love to hear something like that. And I think it's fascinating to dive into. And again, if nothing else, it just gives us more opportunity to have our hands on shotguns and trying to hone our craft and becoming better every day and be having it be a small part of, you know, the thing that we love. So, yeah. No, it's fantastic.
To kind of, to maybe sum up sort of like the burning question that I have, which I think we both have, and it's logical, is that when it comes to this whole idea of increasing your payload beyond the standard payload for a specific gauge, if I were to shoot a 3/4 ounce load of number 8 shot at a bird, at a grouse, let's say, and then I also could shoot at that same bird, and you know, and you could do a scientific experiment, and I could shoot at that bird with 7/8 ounce load or a 1 ounce load of 8 shot through, let's say, a 28 gauge for the sake of this example, how much am I hurting myself? Like, because you've got two theories. Like, one is increasing pattern density and pellet count, but the idea that you might be deforming the shot such that your pattern goes to hell, that's the question that we all want to know the answer to. And
right, and then you start talking about that, how fast are you pushing it?
Yes.
Yep. So if you're talking about a 1 ounce load at 1220 compared to the 3/4 ounce load at 1300, mm-hmm. even if I have a little bit of pellet deformation, or I start to have a little bit more shot string, which one is actually going to produce a more dense target or a more dense pattern?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we slow it down, we don't spread it out as much.
Yes. Is less actually more in this case? That I would
right.
love, I would love to know the answer to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait for you to do some research and share everything. and if I can get my hands on some, I'm going to start tinkering too. So,
yeah.
But well, I know a lot of guys, or a handful of guys, that are like really dedicated to the 28 gauge, and like, I have point blank asked them, and again, this is just a personal opinion. There's people that probably think different, but yep. is there any need for a 20 gauge if you compared to a 28? And the answer across the board has been, I see zero need for a 20 gauge.
Right.
You're not giving up anything unless you start stepping up into an ounce and a quarter. And if you're going to go to an ounce and a quarter, why wouldn't I carry my ounce in an 8/12 gauge and mm-hmm. really yep. have a lot more confidence,
yep.
me personally?
Yeah. It is a block. The thing that I always come back to is, it's an interview that I had at, and I use this, whether or not it's true or not, I mean, if there's anybody out there listening that has a better answer, I would love to hear about it, but I kind of use it as my baseline. And that is when I went to the Federal Ammunition Factory and I interviewed the shot shell engineers, I was kind of getting at this with them. I was talking about the 28 gauge and the square load and everything. And, you know, they kind of not put an end to the conversation, but sort of said, you know, here is the baseline. And that is that as bore diameter increases, so too does pattern efficiency. So that mm-hmm. as your bore size increases, meaning 28, 20, 12, your pattern efficiency is going to increase. So your 12 gauge is going to shoot a 1 ounce load better than a 20 will, better than a 28 mm-hmm. will, and on up the line. So I kind of use that as the baseline, but then you have to sort of take a step back and say, what is the real world approach? And say, well, here I have a 28 gauge. I know I can shoot a 1 ounce load of it and I can kill birds. So what's wrong with that? Right.
Right.
And to some extent, it is what it is. You can shoot a 1 ounce load out of anything from a 28 to a 12 gauge, and that's that for the most part.
Yep.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. And then it's all the subtle nuances in between, and our
yes.
own personal preferences yeah. and terrain and bird we're chasing and sentimental value and yeah. like all these other factors that, you know, are really hard to quantify.
Well, I hope we have thoroughly confused everybody listening, and yeah, as I mentioned, feel free to write in and share your thoughts on this conversation, because this is one of those perpetual debates, and I don't know, it's a fun one to talk about for sure.
Oh, without question.
Well, we didn't get into a whole lot of rough grouse cover and habitat type, but given where we found ourselves with this conversation, I don't think we need to confuse people any more than this. We can chat about that anytime, and would love to have you back on the show at some point. Maybe after you've had a season chasing some forest grouse and have found some success, Levi.
Yeah, after you coach me up. That sounds good.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join me on this episode of the show, man. This was a blast. I enjoyed getting to know you a little bit more and hearing about some of your Western upland hunting adventures. Appreciate it, man, and wish you the best of luck in your move and in your upcoming hunting season. And obviously, we'll keep in touch.
Oh, that would be fantastic. And thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure. It's always great to talk to you, Nick.
You are at Backcountry Levi on Instagram.
Yep.
Folks can follow you there and see what you're up to, what you and the dogs are doing, keeping busy in those beautiful places out west. And yeah, folks can follow you there. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thanks again for the time. Hang on the line here a little bit, but that does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll catch you on the next episode. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast, presented by Onyx Hunt and Final Rise. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, like, and share, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.